to know if we're interested in you.
Why would you be interested in me?
Answer the questions, and we'll find out.
Reacher thought about it, laid his hands palms up on the table.
Okay, he said.
What are the questions?
You know Brewer versus Williams, too,
the guy called Blake said. He was old and overweight and unfit, but his mouth worked fast enough.
Or Duckworth versus Egan?
Poulton asked. Reacher glanced across at him. He was maybe 35, but he looked younger. Like one of those guys who stay looking young forever. Like some kind of a graduate student preserved. His suit was an awful color in the orange light, and his mustache looked false, like it was stuck on with glue.
You know Illinois and Perkins?
Lamar asked. Reacher stared at them both. What the hell is this? Law school?
What about Minnick versus Mississippi?
Blake asked.
Poulton smiled.
McNeil in Wisconsin? Arizona and Fulminante?
Lamar said.
You know what those cases are?
Blake asked. Reacher looked for the trick, but he couldn't see it.
More Supreme Court decisions, he said. Following on for Miranda.
Brewer was 1977, Duckworth 1989, Perkins 1990, Minnick 1990, McNeil 1991, Fulminante 1991. All of them modifying and restating the original Miranda decision. Blake nodded.
Very good.
Lamar leaned forward. The light scattered off the shiny tabletop litter face from below, like a skull.
You knew Amy Callan pretty well, didn't you?
She asked.
Who?
Reacher said.
You heard, you son of a bitch.
Reacher stared at her. Then a woman called Amy Callan came back at him from the past and slowed him, just enough to allow a contented smile to settle on Lamar's bony face.
But you didn't like her much, did you?
She said. There was silence. It built around him.
Okay, my turn,
Kozo said.
Who are you working for?
Reacher swung his gaze slowly to his right and rested it on Kozo.
I'm not working for anybody, he said.
Don't start a turf war with us,
Kozo quoted.
Us is a plural word, more than one person. Who is us, Reacher?
There is no us.
Bullshit, Reacher. Petrosian put the arm on that restaurant, but you were already there. So who sent you?
Reacher said nothing.
What about Caroline Cook?
Lamar called.
You knew her too, right?
Reacher turned slowly back to face her. She was still smiling.
But you didn't like her either, did you?
She said.
Callan and Cook,
Blake repeated.
Give it up, Reacher, from the beginning, okay?
Reacher looked at him.
Give what up?
More silence.
Who sent you to the restaurant?
Kozo asked again.
Tell me right now, and maybe I can cut you a deal.
Reacher turned back the other way. Nobody sent me anywhere. Kozo shook his head.
Bullshit, Reacher. You live in a $500,000 house on the river, in the garrison, and you drive a 6-month-old $45,000 sport utility vehicle. And as far as the IRS knows, you haven't earned a cent in nearly 3 years. And when somebody wanted Petrosian's best boys in the hospital, they sent you to do it. Put all that together, you're working for somebody, and I want to know who the hell it is.
I'm not working for anybody, Reacher said again.
You're a loner, right?
Blake asked.
Is that what you're saying?
Reacher nodded. I guess. He turned his head. Blake was smiling, satisfied.
I thought so, he said. When did you come out of the army?
Reacher shrugged. About 3 years ago.
How long were you in?
All my life. Officer's kid, then an officer myself.
Military policeman, right?
Right.
Several promotions, right?
I was a major.
Medals?
Some.
Silver Star?
One.
First-rate record, right?
Reacher said nothing.
Don't be modest, Blake said. Tell us!
Yes, my record was good.
So why did you muster out?
That's my business.
Something to hide?
You wouldn't understand. Blake smiled.
So, 3 years. What have you been doing?
Reacher shrugged again. Nothing much. Having fun, I guess.
Working?
Not often.
Just bumming around, right?
I guess.
Doing what for money?
Savings.
They ran out 3 months ago. We checked with your bank.
Well, that happens with savings, doesn't it?
So now you're living off Miss Jacob, right? Your girlfriend, who's also your lawyer. How do you feel about that?
Reacher glanced through the glare at the worn wedding band crushing Blake's fat pink finger. No worse than your wife does living off you, I expect, he said. Blake grunted and paused.
So you came out of the army, and since then you've done nothing much, right?
Right.
Mostly on your own.
Mostly.
Happy with that?
Happy enough.
Because you're a loner.
Bullshit, he's working for somebody,
Kozo said.
The man says he's a loner, damn it,
Blake snarled. Deerfield's head was turning left and right between them, like a spectator at a tennis game. The reflected light was flashing in the lenses of his glasses. He held up his hands for silence and fixed Reacher with a quiet gaze. Tell me about Amy Callan and Caroline Cook, he said. What's to tell? Reacher asked. You knew them, right? Sure, way back in the army. So tell me about them. Callan was small and dark. Cook was tall and blonde. Callan was a sergeant. Cook was a lieutenant. Callan was a clerk in ordnance. Cook was in war plans. Where was this? Callan was at Fort Wythe near Chicago. Cook was at NATO headquarters in Belgium.
Did you have sex with either of them?
Lamar asked. Reacher turned to stare at her. What kind of a question is that?
A straightforward one.
Well, no, I didn't.
They were both pretty, right?
Reacher nodded. Prettier than you, that's for damn sure. Lamar looked away and went quiet. Blake turned dark red and stepped into the silence.
Did they know each other?
I doubt it. There's a million people in the army, and they were serving 4,000 miles apart at different times.
And there was no sexual relationship between you and either of them?
No, there wasn't.
Did you attempt one with either of them?
No, I didn't.
Why not? Afraid they'd rebuff you?
Reacher shook his head. I was with somebody else on both occasions, if you really want to know, and one at a time is usually enough for me.
Would you like to have had sex with them?
Reacher smiled briefly. I can think of worse things.
Would they have said yes to you?
Maybe, maybe not.
What's your best guess?
Were you ever in the army? Blake shook his head. And you don't know how it is, Reacher said. Most people in the army would have sex with anything that moves.
So you don't think they'd have rebuffed you?
Reacher kept his gaze tight on Blake's eyes. No, I don't think it would have been a serious worry. There was a long pause. Do you approve of women in the military? Deerfield asked. Reacher's eyes moved across to him.
What?
Answer the question, Reacher. You approve of women in the military. What's not to approve? You think they make good fighters?
Stupid question, Reacher said. You already know they do.
I do?
You were in NAM, right?
I was?
Sure you were, Reacher said. Homicide detective in Arizona in 1976? Made it to the Bureau shortly afterward? Not too many draft dodgers could have managed that. Not there, not back then. So you did your tour, maybe 1970, 1971?
Eyesight like that, you weren't a pilot. Those eyeglasses probably put you right in the infantry. In which case you spent a year getting your ass kicked all over the jungle, and a good third of the people kicking it were women. Good snipers, right?
Very committed, the way I heard it.
Deerfield nodded slowly.
So you like women fighters?
Reacher shrugged. You need fighters. Women can do it the same as anybody else. Russian front, World War II? Women did pretty well there. You ever been to Israel? Women in the front line there, too. And I wouldn't want to put too many U.S. units up against the Israeli defenses, at least not if it was going to be critical who won. So you got no problems at all?
Personally, no.
You got problems otherwise than personally. There are military problems, I guess, Reacher said. Evidence from Israel shows an infantryman is 10 times more likely to stop his advance and help a wounded buddy if the buddy is a woman rather than a man. Slows the advance right down. It needs training out of them.
You don't think people should help each other?
Lamar asked. Sure, Reacher said, but not if there's an objective to capture first.
So, if you and I were advancing together, you'd just leave me if I got wounded.
Reacher smiled. In your case? Without a second thought. How did you meet Amy Callan? Deerfield asked. I'm sure you already know, Reacher said. Tell me anyway, for the record. Are we on the record? Sure we are. Without reading me my rights. The record will show you had your rights any old time I say you had them. Reacher was silent. Tell me about Amy Callan, Deerfield said again.
She came to me with a problem she was having in her unit, Reacher said.
What problem?
Sexual harassment.
Were you sympathetic?
Yes, I was.
Why?
Because I was never abused because of my gender. I didn't see why she should have to be.
So what did you do?
I arrested the officer she was accusing.
And what did you do then?
Nothing. I was a policeman, not a prosecutor. It was out of my hands.
And what happened?
The officer won his case. Amy Callan left the service.
But the officer's career was ruined anyway.
Reacher nodded.
Yes, it was. How did you feel about that?
Reacher shrugged.
Confused, I guess. As far as I knew, he was an okay guy. But in the end, I believed Callan, not him. My opinion was he was guilty, so I guess I was happy he was gone. But it shouldn't work that way, ideally. A not guilty verdict shouldn't ruin a career.
So you felt sorry for him?
No, I felt sorry for Callan. And I felt sorry for the Army. The whole thing was a mess. 2 careers were ruined, where either way only one should have been.
What about Caroline Cook?
Cook was different.
Different how?
Different time, different place. It was overseas. She was having sex with some colonel, had been for a year. It looked consensual to me. She only called it harassment later when she didn't get promoted.
How is that different?
Because it was unconnected. The guy was screwing her because she was happy to let him, and he didn't promote her because she wasn't good enough at her job. The 2 things weren't connected.
Maybe she saw the year in bed as an implied bargain.
Then it was a contractual issue, like a hooker who gets bilked. That's not harassment.
So you did nothing?
Reacher shook his head. No, I arrested the colonel, because by then there were rules. Sex between people of different rank was effectively outlawed.
And?
And he was dishonorably discharged, and his wife dumped him and he killed himself. And Cook quit anyway.
And what happened to you?
I transferred out of NATO HQ.
Why? Upset?
No, I was needed someplace else.
You were needed? Why you?
Because I was a good investigator. I was wasted in Belgium. Nothing much happens in Belgium.
You see much sexual harassment after that?
Sure, it became a very big thing.
Lots of good men getting their careers ruined?
Lamar asked. Reacher turned to face her.
Some.
It became a witch hunt. Most of the cases were genuine, in my opinion. But some innocent people were caught up. Plenty of normal relationships were suddenly exposed. The rules had suddenly changed on them. Some of the innocent victims were men, but some were women, too.
A mess, right?
Blake said.
All started by pesky little women like Callan and Cook.
Reacher said nothing. Kozo was drumming his fingers on the mahogany.
I want to get back to the business with Petrosian, he said.
Reacher swiveled his gaze the other way. There is no business with Petrosian. I never heard of anybody called Petrosian. Deerfield yawned and looked at his watch. He pushed his glasses up onto his forehead and rubbed his eyes with his knuckles.
It's past midnight, you know that? He said.
Did you treat Callan and Cook with courtesy?
Blake asked. Reacher squinted through the glare at Kozo and then turned back to Blake. The hot yellow light from the ceiling was bouncing off the red tint of the mahogany and making his bloated face crimson. Yes, I treated them with courtesy.
Did you see them again after you turned their cases over to the prosecutor?
Once or twice, I guess, in passing.
Did they trust you?
Reacher shrugged. I guess so. It was my job to make them trust me. I had to get all kinds of intimate details from them.
You had to do that kind of thing with many women?
There were hundreds of cases. I handled a couple dozen, I guess, before they set up special units to deal with them all.
So give me a name of another woman whose case you handled.
Reacher shrugged again and scanned back through a succession of offices in hot climates, cold climates. Big desks, small desks, sun outside the window, cloud outside. Hurt and outraged women stammering out the details of their betrayal. Rita Semeca, he said. She would be a random example. Blake paused, and Lamar reached down to the floor and came up with a thick file from her briefcase. She slid it sideways. Blake opened it and turned pages. Traced down a long list with a thick finger and nodded.
Okay, he said. What happened with Ms. Semeca?
She was Lieutenant Semeca, Reacher said. Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The guys called it hazing. She called it gang rape.
And what was the outcome?
She won her case. Three men spent time in military prison and were dishonorably discharged.
And what happened to Lieutenant Semeca?
Reacher shrugged again. At first, she was happy enough. She felt vindicated. Then she felt the army had been ruined for, so she mustered out.
Where is she now?
I have no idea.
Suppose you saw her again someplace. Suppose you were in some town somewhere and you saw her in a store or restaurant. What would she do?
I have no idea. She'd probably say hello, I guess. Maybe we'd talk a while, have a drink or something.
She'd be pleased to see you.
Pleased enough, I guess.
Because she would remember you as a nice guy.
Reacher nodded. It's a hell of an ordeal. Not just the event itself, but the process afterward, too. So the investigator has to build up a bond. The investigator has to be a friend and a supporter.
So the victim becomes your friend?
If you do it right, yes.
What would happen if you knocked on Lieutenant Semeca's door?
I don't know where she lives.
Suppose you did. Would she let you in?
I don't know.
Would she recognize you?
Probably.
And she'd remember you as a friend?
I guess.
So you knock on her door, she'd let you in, right? She'd open up the door and see this old friend of hers, so she'd let you right in, offer you coffee or something, talk a while, catch up on old times.
Maybe, Reacher said. Probably. Blake nodded and stopped talking. Lamar put her hand on his arm, and he bent to listen as she whispered in his ear. He nodded again and turned to Deerfield and whispered in turn. Deerfield glanced at Kozo. The three agents from Quantico sat back as he did so. Just an imperceptible movement, but with enough body language in it to say, "Okay, we're interested." Kozo stared back at Deerfield in alarm. Deerfield leaned forward, staring straight through his glasses at Reacher. "This is a very confusing situation," he said. Reacher said nothing back, just sat and waited.
"Exactly what happened at the restaurant?"
Deerfield asked.
"Nothing happened," Reacher said.
Deerfield shook his head.
"You were under surveillance. My people have been following you for a week. Special Agents Poulton and Lamar joined them tonight. They saw the whole thing."
Reacher stared at him.
"You've been following me for a week?"
Deerfield nodded.
"8 days, actually."
"Why?"
"We'll get to that later."
Lamar stirred and reached down again to her briefcase. She pulled out another file, opened it, and took out a sheaf of papers. There were 4 or 5 sheets clipped together. They were covered in dense type. She smiled icily at Reacher and reversed the sheets and slid them across the table to him. The air caught them and ripped them apart. The clip dragged on the wood and stopped them exactly in front of him. In them, Reacher was referred to as the subject. They were a list of everything he had done and everywhere he had been in the previous 8 days. They were complete to the last second, and they were accurate to the last detail. Reacher glanced from them to Lamar's smiling face and nodded.
"Well, FBI tales are obviously pretty good," he said. "I never noticed."
There was silence.
"So what happened in the restaurant?" Deerfield asked again.
Reacher paused. "Honesty is the best policy," he thought. He scoped it out, swallowed. Then he nodded toward Blake and Lamar and Poulton.
"These law school buffs would call it imperfect necessity, I guess. I committed a small crime to stop a bigger one happening."
"You were acting alone?"
Kozo asked.
Reacher nodded.
"Yes, I was."
"So what was 'Don't Start a Turf War with Us' all about?"
"I wanted it to look convincing. I wanted Petrosian to take it seriously, whoever the hell he is, like he was dealing with another organization."
Deerfield leaned all the way over the table and retrieved Lamar's surveillance log. He reversed it and riffed through it.
"This shows no contact with anybody at all except Ms. Jody Jacob. She's not running protection rackets. What about the phone log?"
"You're tapping my phone?" Reacher asked.
Deerfield nodded.
"We've been through your garbage, too."
"Phone log is clear," Poulton said. "He spoke to nobody except Miss Jacob. He lives a quiet life."
"That right, Reacher?" Deerfield asked. "You live a quiet life?"
"Usually," Reacher said.
"So you were acting alone," Deerfield said. "Just a concerned citizen. No contact with gangsters, no instructions by phone."
He turned to Kozo, a question in his eyes.
"You comfortable with that, James?"
Kozo shrugged and nodded.
"I'll have to be, I guess."
"Concerned citizen, right, Reacher?" Deerfield said.
Reacher nodded, said nothing.
"Can you prove that to us?" Deerfield asked.
Reacher shrugged. "I could have taken their guns. If I was connected, I would have. But I didn't."
"No, you left them in the dumpster."
"I disabled them first.
With grit and the mechanisms.
Why did you do that?"
"So nobody could find them and use them."
Deerfield nodded.
"A concerned citizen. You saw an injustice. You wanted to set it straight."
Reacher nodded back.
"I guess."
"Somebody's got to do it, right?"
"I guess," Reacher said again.
"You don't like injustice, right?"
"I guess not."
"And you can tell the difference between right and wrong?"
"I hope so."
"You don't need the intervention of the proper authorities because you can make your own decisions."
"Usually."
"Confident with your own moral code?"
"I guess."
There was silence. Deerfield looked through the glare.
"So why did you steal their money?"
he asked.
Reacher shrugged.
"Spoils of battle, I guess, like a trophy."
Deerfield nodded.
"Part of the code, right?"
"I guess."
"You play to your own rules, right?"
"Usually."
"You wouldn't mug an old lady, but it was okay to take money off of a couple of hard men."
"I guess."
"When they step outside, what's acceptable to you, they get what they get, right?"
"Right.
A personal code."
Reacher said nothing. The silence built.
"You know anything about criminal profiling?"
Deerfield asked suddenly.
Reacher paused.
"Only what I read in the newspapers."
"It's a science," Blake said. "We developed it at Quantico over many years. Special Agent Lamar here is currently our leading exponent. Special Agent Poulton is her assistant."
"We look at crime scenes," Lamar said. "We look at the underlying psychological indicators, and we work out the type of personality which could have committed the crime."
"We study the victims," Poulton said. "We figure out to whom they could have been especially vulnerable."
"What crimes?" Reacher asked.
"What scenes?" "You son of a bitch," Lamar said.
"Amy Callan and Caroline Cook," Blake said. "Both homicide victims."
Reacher stared at him. Callan was first, Blake said. Very distinctive M.O. But one homicide is just one homicide, right? Then Cook was hit, with the exact same M.O. That made it a serial situation. We looked for a link, Poulton said, between the victims. Not hard to find. Army harassment complaints who subsequently quit.
Extreme organization at the crime scene, Lamar said. Indicative of military precision, maybe. A bizarre, coded M.O. Nothing left behind. No clues of any kind. The perpetrator was clearly a precise person, and clearly a person familiar with investigative procedures. Probably a good investigator himself.
No forced entry at either abode, Poulton said. The killer was admitted to the house in both cases, by the victims, no questions asked.
So the killer was somebody they both knew, Blake said.
Somebody they both trusted, Poulton said. Like a friendly visitor, Lamar said.
There was silence in the room.
That's what he was, Blake said. A visitor. Somebody they regarded as a friend. Somebody they felt a bond with.
A friend visiting, Poulton said. He knocks on the door, they open it up, they say, hi, so nice to see you again. He walks in, Lamar said. Just like that.
There was silence in the room.
We explored the crime psychologically, Lamar said. Why were those women making somebody mad enough to kill them? So we looked for an army guy with a score to settle. Maybe somebody outraged by the idea of pesky women ruining good soldiers' careers and then quitting anyway. Frivolous women driving good men to suicide.
Somebody with a clear sense of right and wrong, Poulton said. Somebody confident enough in his own code to set these injustices right by his own hand. Somebody happy to act without the proper authorities getting in the way, you know?
Somebody both women knew, Blake said. Somebody they knew well enough to let right in the house, no questions asked, like an old friend or something.
Somebody decisive, Lamar said. Maybe like somebody organized enough to think for a second and then go buy a label machine and a tube of glue just to take care of a little ad hoc problem.
More silence.
The army ran them through their computers, Lamar said. You're right. They never knew each other. They had very few mutual acquaintances. Very few. But you were one of them.
You want to know an interesting fact? Blake said. Perpetrators of serial homicide used to drive Volkswagen Bugs. Almost all of them. It was uncanny. Then they switched to minivans. Then they switched to sport utilities. Big four-wheel drives exactly like yours. It's a hell of an indicator.
Lamar leaned across and pulled the sheaf of papers back from Deerfield's place at the table. She tapped them with a finger.
They live solitary lives, she said. They interact with one other person at most. They live off other people, often relatives or friends, often women. They don't do much normal stuff, don't talk much on the phone. They're quiet and furtive.
They're law enforcement buffs, Poulton said. They know all kinds of stuff, like all kinds of obscure legal cases defining their rights.
More silence.
Profiling, Blake said. It's an exact science. It's regarded as good enough evidence to get an arrest warrant in most states of the Union.
It never fails, Lamar said.
She stared at Reacher, and then she sat back with her crooked teeth showing in a satisfied smile. Silence settled over the room.
So? Reacher said.
So somebody killed two women, Deerfield said.
And?
Deerfield nodded to his right, toward Blake and Lamar and Poulton.
And these agents think it was somebody exactly like you.
So?
So we asked you all those questions.
And?
And I think they're absolutely right. It was somebody exactly like you. Maybe it even was you.
Chapter 4
No, it wasn't me, Reacher said. Blake smiled.
That's what they all say.
Reacher stared at him.
You're full of shit, Blake. You've got two women is all. The army thing is probably a coincidence.
There are hundreds of women out there harassed out of the army, maybe thousands. Why jump on that connection? Blake said nothing.
And why a guy like me?
Reacher asked. That's just a guess, too. And that's what this profiling crap comes down to, right? You say a guy like me did it because you think a guy like me did it. No evidence or anything.
There is no evidence, Blake said.
The guy didn't leave any behind, Lamar said. And that's how we work. The perpetrator was obviously a smart guy, so he looked for a smart guy. You saying you're not a smart guy?
Reacher stared at her. There are thousands of guys as smart as me.
No, there are millions, you conceited son of a bitch, she said. But then we started narrowing it down some. A smart guy, a loner, army, knew both victims, movements unaccounted for, a brutal vigilante personality. That narrowed it down from millions to thousands to hundreds to tens, maybe all the way on down to you.
There was silence. Me? Reacher said to her. You're crazy. He turned to Deerfield, who was sitting silent and impassive. You think I did it? Deerfield shrugged. Well, if you didn't, it was somebody exactly like you. And I know you put two guys in the hospital. You're already in big trouble for that. This other matter, I'm not familiar with the case. But the Bureau trusts its experts, that's why we hired them, after all. They're wrong, Reacher said. But can you prove that? Reacher stared at him. Do I have to? What about innocent until proven guilty? Deerfield just smiled. Please, let's stay in the real world, okay? There was silence. Dates, Reacher said. Give me dates and places. More silence. Deerfield stared into space.
Callan was 7 weeks ago, Blake said. Cook was 4.
Reacher scanned back in time. 4 weeks was the start of fall. 7 took him into late summer. Late summer, he had done nothing at all. He had been battling the yard. 3 months of unchecked growth had seen him outdoors every day with scythes and hoes and other unaccustomed tools in his hands. He had gone days at a time without even seeing Jody. She had been tied up with legal cases. She had spent a week overseas in England. He couldn't recall for sure which week it had been. It was a lonely spell, his time absorbed with beating back rampant nature a foot at a time. The start of fall, he'd transferred his energies inside the house. There were things to be done, but he'd done them all alone. Jody had stayed in the city, working her way up the greasy pole. There were random nights together, but that was all. No trips anywhere, no ticket stubs, no hotel registers, no stamps in his passport, no alibis. He looked at the 7 agents ranged against him. I want my lawyer now, he said. The 2 local sentries took him back to the first room. His status had changed. This time they stayed inside with him, 1 standing on each side of the closed door. Reacher sat in the plastic garden chair and ignored them. He listened to the tireless fluttering of the ventilation inside the exposed trunking in the ceiling and waited, thinking about nothing. He waited almost 2 hours. The 2 sentries stood patiently by the door, not looking at him, not speaking, never moving. He stayed in his chair, leaning back, staring at the ducts above his head. There were 2 systems up there. 1 blew fresh air into the room and the other sucked stale air out. The layout was clear. He traced the flow with his eyes and imagined big lazy fans outside on the roof, turning slowly in opposite directions, making the building breathe like a lung. He imagined the spent breath from his body floating away into the Manhattan night sky and out toward the Atlantic. He imagined the damp molecules drifting and diffusing in the atmosphere, catching in the breeze. 2 hours, they could be 20 miles offshore. Or 30. Or 40. It would depend on the conditions. He couldn't remember if it had been a windy night. He guessed not. He recalled the fog. Fog would blow away if there was a decent wind. So it was a still night, and therefore his spent breath was probably hanging sullenly in the air right above the lazy fans. Then there were people in the corridor outside, and then the door opened and the sentry stepped out and Jody walked in. She blazed against the gray walls. She was wearing a pastel peach dress with a wool coat over it a couple of shades darker. Her hair was still lightened from the summer sun. Her eyes were bright blue and her skin was the color of honey. It was the middle of the night, and she looked as fresh as morning.
"Hey, Reacher," she said.
He nodded and said nothing. He could see worry in her face. She stepped close and bent down and kissed him on the lips. She smelled like a flower.
"You talk to them?" he asked her.
"I'm not the right person to deal with this," she said. "Financial law, yes, but criminal law, I've got no idea."
She waited in front of his chair, tall and slim, head cocked to one side, all her weight on one foot. Every new time he saw her, she looked more beautiful. He stood up and stretched, wearily.
"There's nothing to deal with," he said.
She shook her head.
"Yes, there damn well is."
"I didn't kill any women."
She stared at him.
"Of course you didn't. I know that. And they know that, or they'd have put you in handcuffs and leg irons and taken you straight down to Quantico, not dumped you in here. This must be about the other thing. They saw you do that. You put two guys in the hospital with them watching."
"It's not about that. They reacted too fast. This was set up before I even did the other thing. And they don't care about the other thing. I'm not working the rackets. That's all Kozo's interested in, organized crime."
She nodded.
"Kozo's happy, maybe more than happy. He's got two punks off the street, no cost to himself. But it's turned into a catch-22, don't you see that? To convince Kozo, you had to make yourself out as a vigilante loner, and the more you made yourself out as a vigilante loner, the more you pushed yourself into this profile from Quantico. So whatever reason they brought you in for, you're starting to confuse them."
"The profile is bullshit."
"They don't think so."
"It has to be bullshit. It came up with me."
She shook her head.
"No, it came up with somebody like you."
"Whatever. I should just walk out of here."
"You can't do that. You're in big trouble. Whatever else, they saw you beat on those guys, Reacher. FBI agents on duty, for Christ's sake."
"Those guys deserved it."
"Why?"
"Because they were picking on somebody who didn't need picking on."
"See? Now you're making their case for them, a vigilante with his own code."
He shrugged and looked away.
"I'm not the right person for this," she said again.
"I don't do criminal law. You need a better lawyer."
"I don't need any lawyer," he said.
"Yes, Reacher, you need a lawyer. That's for damn sure. This is for real. This is the FBI, for God's sake."
He was silent for a long moment.
"You have to take this seriously," she said.
"I can't," he said. "It's bullshit. I didn't kill any women."
"But you made yourself fit the profile, and now proving them wrong is going to be tough. Proving a negative always is, so you need a proper lawyer."
"They said I'm damaging your career. They said I'm not an ideal corporate husband."
"Well, that's bullshit, too. And even if it was true, I wouldn't care. I'm not saying get a different lawyer for my sake. I'm saying it for yours."
"I don't want any lawyer."
"So why did you call me?"
He smiled. "I thought you might cheer me up."
She stepped into his arms and stretched up and kissed him hard.
"I love you, Reacher,"
she said.
"I really do. You know that, right? But you need a better lawyer. I don't even understand what this is about."
There was a long silence. Just ventilation flutter above their heads. The faint noise of air against metal. The quiet sound of time passing. He listened to it.
"They gave me a copy of the surveillance report," she said.
He nodded. "I thought they would."
"Why?"
"Because it eliminates me from the investigation," he said.
"How?"
"Because this is not about two women," he said.
"It isn't?"
"No. It's about three women. Has to be."
"Why?"
"Because whoever's killing them, he's working to a timetable. You see that? He's on a 3-week cycle. 7 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. So the next one has already happened this past week. They put me under surveillance to eliminate me from the investigation."
"So why did they haul you in if you're eliminated?"
"I don't know," he said.
"Maybe the timetable fell apart. Maybe he stopped it, too."
"Nobody stops it, too. You do more than one, you do more than two.
Maybe he fell ill and took a break. Could be months before the next one.
He was silent.
Maybe he was arrested for something else, she said. That happens time to time, something unconnected, you know? He could be in jail 10 years. They'll never know it was him. You need a good lawyer, Reacher, somebody better than me. This isn't going to be easy.
You were supposed to cheer me up, you know that.
No, I was supposed to give you advice.
He stared at her, suddenly uncertain.
There's the other thing, too, she said. The two guys. You're in trouble for that, whatever.
They should thank me for that.
Doesn't work that way, she said.
He was silent.
This is not the army, Reacher, she said. You can't just drag a couple of guys behind the motor pool and beat some sense into them anymore. This is New York. This is civilian stuff now. They're looking at you for something bad, and you can't just pretend they're not.
I didn't do anything.
Wrong, Reacher. You put two guys in the hospital. They watched you do it. Bad guys for sure, but there are rules here. You broke them.
Then there were heavy footsteps in the corridor outside, loud and heavy. Maybe three men hurrying. The door opened. Deerfield stepped into the room. The two local boys crowded his shoulder. Deerfield ignored Reacher and spoke directly to Jody.
"Your client conference is over, Ms. Jacob," he said.
Deerfield led the way back to the room with the long table. The two local agents sandwiched Reacher between them and followed him. Jody trailed the four of them through the door. She blinked in the glare of the lights. A second chair had been placed over on the far side. Deerfield stood and pointed at it silently. Jody glanced at him and moved around the end of the table and sat down with Reacher. He squeezed her hand under the cover of the shiny mahogany slab. The two local boys took up station against the walls. Reacher stared forward through the glare. The same lineup was ranged against him. Poulton, Lamar, Blake, Deerfield, and then Kozo, sitting isolated between two empty chairs. Now there was a squat black audio recorder on the table. Deerfield leaned forward and pressed a red button. He announced the date and the time and the place. He identified the 9 occupants of the room. He placed his hands in front of him.
"This is Alan Deerfield speaking to the suspect, Jack Reacher," he said. "You are now under arrest on the following 2 counts."
He paused.
"One, for aggravated assault and robbery," he said, "against 2 persons yet to be definitively identified."
James Kozo leaned forward.
"Two, for aiding and abetting a criminal organization engaged in the practice of extortion."
Deerfield smiled.
"You are not obliged to say anything. If you do say anything, it will be recorded and may be used as evidence against you in a court of law. You're entitled to be represented by an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you by the state of New York."
He leaned forward to the recording machine and pressed the stop button.
"So did I get it right? Seeing as how you're the big expert on Miranda."
Reacher said nothing. Deerfield smiled again and pressed the red button, and the machine hummed back into life.
"Do you understand your rights?" he asked.
"Yes," Reacher said. "Do you have anything to say at this point?"
"No."
"That it?" Deerfield asked.
"Yes," Reacher said.
Deerfield nodded.
"Noted."
He reached forward and clicked the recording machine to off.
"I want a bail hearing,"
Jody said. Deerfield shook his head.
"No need," he said. "We'll release him on his own recognizance."
Silence in the room.
"What about the other matter?"
Jody asked.
"The women."
"That investigation is continuing," Deerfield said. "Your client is free to go."
Chapter 5. He was out of there just after 3 in the morning. Jody was agitated, torn between staying with him and getting back to the office to finish her all-nighter. He convinced her to calm down and go do her work. One of the local guys drove her down to Wall Street. They gave him back his possessions except for the wad of stolen cash. Then the other local guy drove him back to Garrison, hustling hard, 58 miles in 47 minutes. He had a red beacon on the dash connected to the cigar lighter with a cord, and he kept it flashing the whole way. The beam swept through the fog. It was the middle of the night, dark and cold, and the roads were damp and slick. The guy said nothing, just drove and then jammed to a stop at the end of Reacher's driveway in Garrison, and took off again as soon as the passenger door slammed shut. Reacher watched the flashing light disappear into the river mist and turned to walk down to his house. He had inherited the house from Leon Garber, who was Jody's father and his old commanding officer. It had been a week of big surprises, both good and bad, back at the start of the summer. Meeting Jody again, finding out she'd been married and divorced, finding out that old Leon was dead, finding out the house was his. He had been in love with Jody for 15 years, since he first met her on a base in the Philippines. She had been 15 herself then, right on the cusp of spectacular womanhood, and she was his CO's daughter, and he had crushed his feelings down like a guilty secret and never let them see the light of day. He felt they would have been a betrayal of her, and of Leon, and betraying Leon was the last thing he would have ever done, because Leon was a rough and ready prince among men, and he loved him like a father, which made him feel Jody was his sister. And you don't feel that way about your sister. Then chance had brought him to Leon's funeral, and he had met Jody again, and they had sparred uneasily for a couple of days before she admitted she felt the exact same things and was concealing her feelings for the exact same reasons. It was a thunderclap, a glorious sunburst of happiness in a summer week of big surprises. So meeting Jody again was the good surprise, and Leon dying was the bad one, no doubt about it. But inheriting the house was both good and bad. It was a $500,000 slice of prime real estate standing proudly on the Hudson opposite West Point, and it was a comfortable building, but it represented a big problem. It anchored him in a way which made him profoundly uncomfortable. Being static disconcerted him. He had moved around so often in his life, it confused him to spend time in any one particular place. And he had never lived in a house before. Bunkhouses and service bungalows and motels were his habitat. It was ingrained. And the idea of property worried him. His whole life, he had never owned more than would fit into his pockets. As a boy, he had owned a baseball and not much else. As an adult, he had once gone 7 whole years without owning anything at all, except a pair of shoes he preferred to the Defense Department issue. Then a woman bought him a wallet with a clear plastic window with her photograph in it. He lost touch with the woman and junked the photograph, but kept the wallet. Then he went the remaining 6 years of his service life with just the shoes and the wallet. After mustering out, he added a toothbrush. It was a plastic thing that folded in half and clipped into his pocket like a pen. He had a wristwatch. It was Army issue, so it started out theirs and became his when they didn't ask for it back. And that was it. Shoes on his feet, clothes on his back, small bills in his pants, big bills in his wallet, a toothbrush in his pocket, and a watch on his wrist. Now, he had a house. And a house is a complicated thing. A big, complicated, physical thing. It started with the basement. The basement was a huge, dark space with a concrete floor, and concrete walls and floor joists exposed overhead like bones. There were pipes and wires and machines down there. A furnace. Buried outside somewhere was an oil tank. There was a well for the water. Big, round pipes ran through the wall to the septic system. It was a complex, interdependent machine, and he didn't know how it worked. Upstairs looked more normal. There was a warren of rooms, all of them amiably shabby and unkempt, but they all had secrets. Some of the light switches didn't work. One of the windows was jammed shut. The range in the kitchen was too complicated to use. The whole place creaked and cracked at night, reminding him it was real, and there, and needed thinking about. And a house has an existence beyond the physical. It's also a bureaucratic thing. Something had come in the mail about title. There was insurance to consider. Taxes. Town tax, school tax, inspection, assessment. There was a bill to pay for garbage collection, and something about a scheduled propane delivery. He kept all that kind of mail in a drawer in the kitchen. The only thing he had bought for the house was a gold-colored filter cone for Leon's old coffee machine. He figured it was easier than always running to the store to buy the paper kind. 4:10 that morning, he filled it with coffee from a can and added water and set the machine going. Rinsed out a mug at the sink and set it on the counter, ready. Sat on a stool and leaned his elbows and watched the dark liquid sputtering into the flask. It was an old machine, inefficient, maybe a little furred up inside. It generally took 5 minutes to finish. Somewhere during the fourth of those 5 minutes, he heard a car slowing on the road outside. The hiss of damp pavement. The crunch of tires on his asphalt drive. Jody couldn't stand to stay at work, he thought. That hope endured about a second and a half until the car came around the curve and the flashing red beam started sweeping over his kitchen window. It washed left to right, cutting through the river mist, and then it died into darkness and the motor noise died into silence. Doors open and feet touched the ground. 2 people. Doors slammed shut. He stood up and killed the kitchen light. Looked out of the window and saw the vague shapes of 2 people peering into the fog, looking for the path that led up to his front door. He ducked back to the stool and listened to their steps on the gravel. They paused. The doorbell rang. There were 2 light switches in the hallway. 1 of them operated a porch light. He wasn't sure which one. He gambled and got it right and saw a glow through the fan light. He opened the door. The bulb out there was a spotlight made of thick glass tinted yellow. It threw a narrow beam downward from high on the right. The beam caught Nelson Blake first, and then the parts of Julia Lamar that weren't in his shadow. Blake's face was showing nothing except strain. Lamar's face was still full of hostility and contempt.
"You're still up,"
Blake said. A statement, not a question. Reacher nodded. "Come on in, I guess," he said. Lamar shook her head. The yellow light caught her hair.
"We'd rather not," she said.
Blake moved his feet.
"There's some place we can go, get some breakfast."
4:30 in the morning, Reacher said. "Not around here."
"Can we talk in the car?"
Lamar asked. "No," Reacher said. "Impasse." Lamar looked away and Blake shuffled his feet. "Come on in," Reacher said again. "I just made coffee." He walked away back to the kitchen, pulled a cupboard door and found 2 more mugs, rinsed the dust out of them at the sink, and listened to the creak of the hallway floor as Blake stepped inside. Then he heard Lamar's lighter tread and the sound of the door closing behind her. "Black is all I got," he called. "No milk or sugar in the house, I'm afraid."
"Black is fine," Blake said.
He was in the kitchen doorway, moving sideways, staying close to the hallway, unwilling to trespass. Lamar was moving alongside him, looking around the kitchen with undisguised curiosity.
"Nothing for me," she said.
"Drink some coffee, Julia," Blake said. "It's been a long night."
The way he said it was halfway between an order and paternalistic concern. Reacher glanced at him, surprised, and filled 3 mugs. He took his own and leaned back on the counter, waiting.
"We need to talk," Blake said.
"Who was the 3rd woman? Reacher asked.
"Lorraine Stanley. She was a quartermaster sergeant."
"Where?"
"She served in Utah someplace. They found her dead in California this morning."
"Same M.O.?" Blake nodded.
"Identical in every respect."
"Same history?" Blake nodded again.
"Harassment complainant. Won her case, but quit anyway."
"When?"
"The harassment thing was 2 years ago. She quit a year ago. So that's 3 out of 3. So the army thing is not a coincidence, believe me."
Reacher sipped his coffee. It tasted weak and stale. The machine was obviously all furred up with mineral deposits. There was probably a procedure for cleaning it out. "I never heard of her," he said. "I never served in Utah." Blake nodded.
"Somewhere we can talk."
"We're talking here, right?"
"Somewhere we can sit."
Reacher nodded and pushed off the counter and led the way into the living room. He set his mug on the side table and pulled up the blinds to reveal pitch dark outside. The windows faced west over the river. It would be hours until the sun got high enough to lighten the sky out there. There were three sofas in a rectangle around a cold fireplace full of last winter's ash, the last cheery blazes Jody's father had ever enjoyed. Blake sat facing the window and Reacher sat opposite and watched Lamar as she fought her short skirt and sat down facing the hearth. Her skin was the same color as the ash.
"We stand by our profile," she said.
"Well, good for you."
"It was somebody exactly like you."
"You think that's plausible?"
Blake asked.
"Is what plausible?" Reacher asked back.
"That this could be a soldier."
"You're asking me if a soldier could be a killer?"
Blake nodded.
"You got an opinion on that?"
"My opinion is it's a really stupid question. Like asking me if I thought a jockey could ride a horse." There was silence. Just a muffled whoomp from the basement as the furnace caught, and then rapid creaking as the steam pipes heated through and expanded and rubbed against the floor joists under their feet.
"So, you were a plausible suspect," Blake said, "as far as the first two went."
Reacher said nothing.
"Hence the surveillance," Blake said.
"Is that an apology?" Reacher asked.
Blake nodded.
"I guess so."
"So why did you haul me in, when you already proved it wasn't me?" Blake looked embarrassed.
"We wanted to show some progress, I guess."
"You show progress by hauling the wrong guy in? I don't buy that."
"I already apologized," Blake said.
More silence. "You got anybody who knew all three?" Reacher asked.
"Not yet," Lamar said.
"We're thinking maybe previous personal contact isn't too significant," Blake said.
"You were thinking it was a couple of hours ago. You were telling me how I was this big friend of theirs. I knock on the door, they let me right in."
"Not you," Blake said. "Somebody like you is all. And now we're thinking maybe we were wrong. This guy is killing by category, right? Female harassment complainants who quit afterward? So maybe he's not personally known to them. Maybe he's just in a category known to them. Like the military police."
Reacher smiled. "So now you think it was me again?" Blake shook his head.
"No, you weren't in California."
"Wrong answer, Blake. It wasn't me, because I'm not a killer."
"You never killed anybody," Lamar
said, like she knew the answer. "Only those who needed it." She smiled in turn.
"Like I said, we stand by our profile. Some self-righteous son of a bitch just like you."
Reacher saw Blake glance at her, half supportive, half disapproving. The light from the kitchen was coming through the hallway behind her, turning her thin hair to a wispy halo, making her look like a death's head. Blake sat forward, trying to force Reacher's attention his way.
"What we're saying is, it's possible this guy is or was a military policeman."
Reacher looked away from Lamar and shrugged.
"Anything's possible," he said.
Blake nodded.
"And, you know, we kind of understand that maybe your loyalty to the service makes that hard to accept."
"Actually, common sense makes that hard to accept."
"In what way?"
"Because you seem to think trust and friendship is important to the M.O. in some way. And nobody in the service trusts an M.P., or likes them much, in my experience."
"You told us Rita Semeca would remember you as a friend."
"I was different. I put the effort in. Not many of the guys did." Silence again. The fog outside was dulling sound, like a blanket over the house. The water forcing through the radiators was loud.
"There's an agenda here," Blake said. "Like Julia says, we stand behind our techniques. And the way we read it, there's an army involvement. The victim category is way too narrow for this to be random."
"So?"
"As a rule, the Bureau and the military don't get along too well."
"Well, there's a big surprise. Who the hell do you guys get along with?" Blake nodded. He was in an expensive suit. It made him look uncomfortable, like a college football coach on alumni day.
"Nobody gets on with anybody," he said. "You know how it is.
with all the rivalries. When you were serving, did you ever cooperate with civilian agencies?
Reacher said nothing.
So you know how it is, Blake said again.